ACEC is excited to announce that registration is now open for its fall conference taking place in Marco Island, Florida, this October. That's right, after a year of Zoom and virtual meetings, we're excited to be bringing our fall conference back as an in-person event. And we can't tell you how excited we are to look forward to seeing you there in person for all of the content, networking, and education that the fall conference is known for. Log on to www.acec.org for more information. We can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Renewables are the fastest growing sector in the energy market, with solar and wind expected to make up 70% of utility scale electricity generation capacity domestic additions in 2021. Critical to current and future expansions of the renewables market is battery storage, because solar and wind are intermittent, but energy demand is constant. Storage technologies have developed at a rapid pace in recent years, but what about going forward? What can we expect in energy storage sector in 2035? Well, AERUP provides an answer to that question in its report, Future of Energy 2035. What will a future U.S. energy storage look like? Joining us on the program are two authors of the report. Cole Roberts is the energy business leader for the Americas region, and Jeff Gunn is the energy systems lead. Welcome to the program.
Great, thanks for having us. Jay.
So in the report, you highlight the spread of virtual power plants that maximize the Internet of Things networks and which will dramatically enhance utilities' ability to meet the needs of intermittent renewable generating systems. What are those?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, as we're seeing, there's a proliferation of, you know, small interconnected devices. You've got your thermostats. I think, you know, most of us probably have smart thermostats these days. Appliances, wearables, these days even cars are interconnected and able to communicate, you know, where they are and talk to the cloud. And so soon, you know, most of the energy consuming parts of our houses and our lives are going to be interconnected together and able to communicate and share information with each other, make decisions based on this. And, you know, so for example, my thermostat, you know, knows how I behave. It adjusts the temperature appropriately based on my typical daily patterns. And then it also goes and learns and anticipates when I'm going to be home, what temperature I'd like, all that kind of stuff. They pull data. Pretty soon they'll probably start looking at our calendars and adjusting. So you can kind of imagine a scenario where you wake up in the morning, your house has set the temperature based on when it thought you would wake up. Maybe it was based on the schedule. Maybe it was looking at your phone's calendar for the day. And, you know, furthermore, your car's also then kind of looked at that and it's figured out, okay, I'm going to charge, you're going to go 40 miles to your first meeting, and then you're going to sit there for an hour, and then you're going to come home, and it's charged based on that level of, you know, anticipation for what you're going to do. And then it's gone to the next level and said, okay, in order to get to that here, I'm going to charge at this time of day. That's going to be, you know, beneficial for how the grid is operating. So either during times of low carbon or excess generation, and perhaps it's then discharged actually to help cool your house in the morning or heat your house in the morning. And so all these things will be able to work together to manage our overall impact on the utility grid.
I've been taking it, my electric toothbrush is, I mean, are we talking it to down to that level?
I don't think we need to be down to that level. I think, you know, as we move and kind of, you look at there's like 8 or 7 kind of major energy consumers in your house. It's things like your oven, your refrigerator, your HVAC, your microwave. I think it's kind of those things together. Also, as we move to electric vehicles, I think it's you know, likely we'll leave them plugged in and they'll operate as a two-way kind of power flow battery. You might not need a standalone battery for your house anymore. You look at like the new F-150 coming out, right? It's got a battery in there that will back up your house when you lose utility power. Wow. So it's likely these things will start to work kind of by default and all talking together.
One point you made throughout the white paper report was that government subsidies are sort of necessary. I'll just point out a couple for combined power purchase agreement tenders, government-backed programs to expand publicly available EV charging infrastructure, incentives to make EVs cost competitive, and residential solar and storage. Is that something that has to happen? Do you expect it to happen? What's the view on, what's your view on government subsidies?
Well, I think, you know, no major infrastructure transformation in the history of the country has happened without some degree of subsidy or intervention that's supportive of that transition. And it's already happening. There's already support for it across state, local, and even federal government. Now, that belies, I think, the reality that many of these technologies already make cost-effective sense. And the core is really about how do you rapidly transform the market. So you've got moments where it's cost effective, but there's an established industry, there's an established means of operating and building out infrastructure, and that requires large scale and wholesale transformation. And that takes concerted effort on the part of policymakers as well as the private sector. So it's all of those things moving in concert together that are necessary. And we do think policy and strategic subsidy is appropriate.
And I mean, up to now, the states have sort of been leading the way on a lot of these renewable strategies and providing subsidies to companies within the state to meet their goal, their goals. Do you expect to see states lead or the federal government lead? Or?
I think you're going to see states continue to drive the initiatives that they've committed to. In the current political environment, you're going to see a burgeoning of federal alignment to the state's ambitions.
Another area that you focus on is distributed generation. And that basically, for what the report suggests to have happened, we need a dramatic expansion of distributed generation. How does this work? Will this require the power generators and electric utilities to sort of figure out a new business model rather than the one that right now, which is just essentially provide power to consumers?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a few things. You know, we had kind of forecast, I think, about 30% renewables on the grid by 2030. I was looking at a study the other day. It looks like we might hit some of those numbers significantly earlier than that. I think in particular, you know, solar is actually, even in the last year since we issued this report, has drastically exceeded our kind of expectations in the forecasts. And what I think we're going to need to see in the energy markets is a shift from kind of the current structures that are a little bit more focused on paying for the energy consumed, the kilowatt hours. And, you know, especially as we get more solar and wind that are kind of zero marginal cost resources, we're going to need to figure out how we develop structures that appropriately compensate the services that the utility interconnection, the wires and all of that provides. And services like energy storage can provide as well. And so I think that there's going to be a big shift and we're going to start to see demand components of our bills really driving the pricing and getting appropriate pricing signals as well down to the consumer level to enable things like, you know, residential scale energy storage to participate in a wide range of utility markets. And so that kind of transformation is gonna put the appropriate kind of costs and signals and benefits all together so that we can move this forward and then start to get rid of, you know, perhaps some of those subsidies and things that Cole was talking about a minute ago.
And does that also,
Just to add one thing to that, Jerry, you know, one thing I really like about the Future of Energy report that was put out is that it places us in that future, just a decade to 15 years away. And it talks about the directionality of the flow of energy within our country. And, you know, the unidirectional flow is going to be a thing of the past, and the bidirectional flow from consumers and producers, the demand supply is going to shift. And that by nature means that the business models change.
And in recent years, I mean, the utilities have had difficulty sort of figuring this out. They want to charge people to put stuff back onto the grid. I guess we're just, the market will figure this out, competition, and some utility somewhere will figure out a good model, and then others will mirror that.
I think it's a challenge because there's you know, inherently some tension between, you've got public utility commissions, you've got the electrical distribution or load serving entity companies, you know, that do the wires in between, you've got the folks owning the generation, and you've got to balance that with managing energy costs, issues of equity, all these kind of things that are very challenging and all coming together. And at the same time, you need to fundamentally kind of reinvent how we're doing a lot of this. So I think there is going to be some tension, some challenge as we try and transition. But eventually we'll get to the point, I think, where some market factors start to move it. I think an interesting example in Massachusetts, the Department of Energy Resources, or DOER, has put together what they've called the Clean Peak Standard. And this is an incentive to help control dispatch of on-site energy storage systems that are charged primarily through renewable energy, in this case, generally solar and storage. And the way they've structured this incentive is to pay for discharge during times when statistically the grid has the highest carbon content. So it to me is a good example of an incentive that's bridging the gap from the current kind of state of being to a future where we have market signals that actually kind of financially reward and directly are linked towards grid embodied carbon. So right now it's kind of a synthetic metric that they've put together, because right now we don't have any, especially at smaller scale, small commercial, residential, we don't have those direct market links and signals to do that. So, we will see as this all transitions, those signals become more obvious. They become easier to enact at the smaller scale level at the residents. And those will then also be supported by, regulations from the public utility commissions, the load serving entities, et cetera.
One challenge of writing about something that's going to happen 15 years in the future is you basically are dealing with what's today, and you don't know what arrives tomorrow. In your report, you basically showed the expansion of current technologies and what they could be. Do you expect to see new technologies pop up that might be game changers?
I would say we definitely do. What I see right now is, and I'm going to go back to the market signals again, but when you're looking at energy storage, it's still, it's maturing, but it's still, kind of a burgeoning technology. And similarly, the market signals and the pricing is in development as well. And so I think right now, if you were to go and try and get investment to develop new energy storage technologies, there's still a lot of risk in that marketplace. As we start to transition and put more intrinsic value on the ability to load shift and to provide energy storage of various means, I think that will reduce some of the risk in that marketplace for technology innovators and developers, which will then, I think, in turn lead to new technologies and new approaches. So that they can, the commercial risk and commercial frameworks are all set up and there. And, we're starting to see that. There's things like gravity storage where they raise up concrete blocks via cranes during times when they want to store energy and then discharge them later. There's compressed air storage. There's all sorts of things like that we're starting to see, but are still in the very early stages.
I think that the add to that is that the technology that we have today is already evident in what we think the 2035 energy system will be. So we're undoubtedly a nation of innovators and inventors, and there will be new technology. Some of it may be game changing, but we're not stating that energy system of 2035 is only about new invention. It's the stuff that we know is out there today that's viable, reliable, but not yet scaled.
And that's what the from here to 2035 is essentially scaling what we have today.
Big part of it is the transformation of our energy system.
And I think intentionally part of the reason we picked 2035 and not 2050 is that to us that marks, I think, a very significant time in the transformation of our energy systems, right? We're in the midst. There are technologies that are maturing and improving. There's things that have been proliferating. There's still a lot of unknown into how we're going to get to a kind of completely decarbonized energy economy. And so 2035 is a very interesting time just kind of along that journey towards decarbonization. We're not looking back from 2050 and telling you, here's the solution, here's the way it's going to pan out. But this is a key way that we think, on the road to decarbonization, where a lot of the solutions have started to become clear and some of the challenges and questions are also, more present and have more opportunities for solution.
To someone such as myself, it also seems more doable. 15 years is something I can account for. 30 years, I'm a little too old for that. A lot of people are banking on hydrogen as being sort of the golden solution. How big a role do you see that hydrogen playing in the whole system?
So Arup does have a global perspective, and we are working across Australasia, UK, Europe, as well as the Americas on hydrogen projects from generation through transmission and end use. So we see it as something that's coming. It's here already in select areas of our global economy, and it's a necessary part of a larger energy transition, especially for those aspects of our very diverse system of end uses, industrial heat, for example, long-haul mobility that provides a cost-effective and appropriate means of leveraging we have very good existing infrastructure that we don't think should be abandoned, that we think can be utilized in a hydrogen future, and that's a key aspect of that overall energy transition.
And you also mentioned, speaking of our existing infrastructure, you mentioned in the report that we have all the natural gas pipeline networks, and you refer to them as a substantial energy storage asset with a week's worth of fuel available on demand. I was thrown by this. Is this that basically the gas would sit in the pipelines waiting for a time when it's needed rather than be flowing through it as it does now? What are you saying there?
So this comes out of some work out of UCI by Dr. Jack Brower, who we've had a lot of discussions with and collaborated with on some things. And essentially, if you look at the existing natural gas distribution system, there is inherently a lot of storage in it already. There are tanks throughout. There's gas in pipes. And if you look at that and the overall kind of volume and capacity of that system compared to things like battery energy storage, it appears like it provides a much better opportunity for long-term energy storage for seasonal shifting. So, moving from summer to winter. And so it's an existing asset that we would be remiss to completely discount.
So it would be used sort of when needed?
No, I think we're also anticipating, as Cole mentioned earlier, there's this kind of spectrum of decarbonization, and on one end, I think there's applications that are very easy to electrify, passenger vehicles, single family, residential, a lot of those things that, just make sense, right? Then there's also areas that are much more difficult to electrify, long haul trucking, air travel, shipping, heating in dense urban areas. And so we anticipate that there's certainly a role for existing gas distribution assets to play in providing decarbonized gas, you know, I think hydrogen we think is a strong candidate to serve that role, to those areas, right? If you look at district energy systems that we have throughout a lot of cities in North America, there's opportunities there to, you know, potentially refeed those with that decarbonized gas through the existing pipelines. You know, if you look at some of the things that offshore wind is doing, they're looking at old power plants to connect in from an electrical perspective. A lot of those might also be natural gas fired and have big gas pipelines. So potentially those could also be hubs for electrolysis that we could use to feed into the system. You know, we've even gone so far being in Boston looking at, are there opportunities to leverage the growing offshore wind and the opportunity in the Northeast to produce significant amounts of hydrogen and flip the natural gas pipelines backwards. And actually, instead of putting the Northeast at the end of the natural gas pipeline, maybe we're the start and maybe we're sending decarbonized gas, hydrogen back to the Midwest.
Regional competition here, it's great. You mentioned electric vehicles, and you estimate that by 2035, about a third of all private cars in the United States will be electric, and the majority of the commercial fleet. And we talked about the subsidies for charging stations, and are these also, I think you mentioned it, in discharging stations where we basically turn electric vehicles and the commercial fleet into batteries for the rest of us?
I think our work, AIRIP's work on this has touched on two major realities. One is that 95% of the time our vehicles are in our country are sitting stationary, unoccupied and undriven. So that's, you know, speaking to what Jeff was mentioning earlier, the amount of storage and ability for those vehicles, those assets, to participate in the energy system is tremendous. And you're seeing early indications of vehicle grid integration already. The second aspect is that we need an equitable distribution of EV technology through our cities and our communities. And our communities are diverse places, some, you know, higher density, economic differences. We feel very strongly that an equitable distribution of EV charging infrastructure is necessary and a precursor to that larger scale transition. So that's why we've been working on Charge for All. I encourage your listeners to go and seek out Charge for All as a means to highlight and accelerate electric vehicle transitions in an equitable manner throughout our cities and our communities.
And I think just to build on what Cole was talking about a little bit, you know, the average passenger vehicle travels less than 30 miles per day. And yet the market is, due to things like range anxiety, is moving to vehicles that get 200 plus miles. So we're using, you know, maybe 15% of the battery capacity on a day. And you've got this big 75 kilowatt hour battery sitting in everybody's house that could very easily be just plugged in and leveraged for two-way power flows. Similarly, on the heavy duty side, somewhere around 80% of heavy duty trucks have less than a 200 mile per day duty cycle, which is something that is very easily electrifiable with today's technology and, you know, reasonably sized batteries. And so I think the push to electrify vehicles is actually going to happen a lot faster than we think. There is a lot of, you know, concern about long haul trucks and things like that, but there's already something like 5 million heavy duty electric or heavy duty trucks that can be electrified without a significant impact on the grid, without needing, you know, massive megawatt charging stations, that can be charged overnight at reasonable rates and then deployed readily on, you know, significant routes. And that makes up for, I believe, something like 50% of the total vehicle miles for heavy duty trucks.
And you mentioned, you know, the residential, that the car just sits there at our homes. In your report, you talk about you foresee solar PV with battery storage becoming the standard as a resilient system for individual buildings. How widespread do you see that? Do you see that residential through commercial? Is that primary commercial? How would that work?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's something that certainly our clients are asking us on every project. You know, there's this concept of the building as a battery and supporting the grid and everything. And I think when we talk about, you know, a significant number of buildings, they're definitely on the smaller scale. This is the single family residence, the strip malls, the, you know, small commercial office buildings, where you can get a reasonable amount of solar on site, you know, particularly if there's large parking areas where you can do, you know, PV canopies, and then putting in solar that can participate in the various grid programs and things we've been talking about and leverage to generate a return on investment in the business as usual, but then also provide a resilience backstop. I think, you know, if you start looking at 200,000 square foot labs in dense urban environments, those are going to be very challenging to use solar and storage to provide a significant resilience benefit. But there's, you know, significant millions of square feet in much more rural or less dense areas where you can get enough solar on to be able to provide kind of meaningful backup.
We're tremendously excited by the work that's happening around the country on solar resilience. So you can also look that up. Your listeners can look up solarresilient.org and use that tool set. Solar resilience being applied to critical facilities that are places of refuge when there is a significant hazard that impacts a community, whether that's a hurricane, tornado, wildfire, heat. Those are the facilities that need to be prioritized for backup power and decarbonized backup power that doesn't require combustion generators, diesel gensets to come in at a moment's notice when there's an issue. So look that up. I encourage a great conversation on that. You're seeing movement both in the East Coast and in the West Coast, I think also down south, where those systems are going out to RFP, and they're doing it at a portfolio scale. So it's not just one-off resilience hubs, it's collections in aggregate of literally hundreds of buildings that are moving forward.
For that, Cole. And I think, you know, there's also the concept of being resilient enough, and that some resilience is better than no resilience. And a lot of the sites that we've looked at for this, there's, you know, really good opportunities to provide some base level services that might not have otherwise been there. You know, we've looked at multifamily residential unit developments and how we could put solar and storage in those backup things like ventilation air systems or small opportunity charging in maybe a centralized area, so that the residents can stay in their building using a system that can be procured through a PPA, doesn't add any capital costs to the development, and now get some, you know, resilient benefit from that without putting, you know, more generators in and fossil fuels. And so I think there's a lot of good opportunities there, and just looking at the right way to use it and the right way to get the benefits.
Jerry, what's so wonderful about it is that it's an equitable distribution of that future energy system, because we all have community rec centers, we all have schools, we all have places of worship, we all have libraries. Those are in all of our communities, and those are the places that we depend on, and they need to be resilient and they need to be decarbonized.
And is it the communities that are working with this organization rather than individual multifamily buildings?
I think you're seeing both. So depending on the community, you either have, so for example, in the California Bay Area, you have community choice aggregators. These are load serving entities that are acting as conveners for advancing critical facilities in dozens of cities, working in concert with local community organizations and utility and city staff. In other communities, I think on the East Coast, you're seeing a lot more resilience hubs being progressed. And those, I think, are coming both from the municipal level as well as the county level to be moved forward. And again, close collaboration with the community. And then multi-unit dwellings. I think large national organizations, developers of multi-unit dwellings, are seeing resilience hubs within their developments as a cornerstone of their own resilience strategy in protecting their residents.
Well, we really are coming a long way, aren't we? It's great to hear.
exciting.
Yeah, I think one of the things about multi-unit housing that's really interesting to talk about is as we start to decarbonize that and move towards all electric, multi-unit housing, we're starting to see much larger centralized loads. You know, we're using centralized heat pumps for heating and cooling in some cases, so it's not tied to individual units. And what this means is that we can connect larger solar PV systems behind the kind of house meter to offset these new increased electrical loads. But then we can also provide backup more easily to those systems that then benefit all of the users within. So to me, this is a really interesting kind of side effect of the decarbonization and electrification, is that it actually helps us provide carbon-free resilience for these units.
Jerry, may I add one more thing?
Totally, yeah.
I think that, as I said earlier, we have a diverse and beautiful country, and that diversity goes into effect with what aspects of decarbonized resilience do we need throughout the country is going to vary. So if you look at electrical resilience in California, for example, the natural gas network or the gas network is noticeably a less resilient system because you have earthquake risk that can significantly impact the gas network. Versus, say, in the Midwest, where you may have more challenges with the electrical distribution system, or maybe in the South, right, where you don't have earthquake risk, but you have more electric system risk because of high velocity wind events, for example. So resilience, we don't think resilience is only solar and battery storage. You have a decarbonized resilience strategy that can leverage hydrogen as well. And that needs to progress in that future energy system of 2035.
Great. I think that sort of gives us a great sense of what you guys did. We'll put a link to the report in the show notes so people can download the AIRUP report, which is titled, I've lost it already, the energy system in 2035, what will a future U.S. energy storage look like? Thanks, both of you, for taking the time to speak with us.
Jerry, can we send you the Charge for All site and the Solar Resilient site? And if you think that would be valuable for your listeners.
Yes, please do. I'll put the links in as well. So, well, great. Well, thanks. And you've been listening to the Engineering Influence podcast presented by ACEC and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust.